This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unofawakin.
This week, Edward Snowden tells all, Uber and Lyft play dirty, BuzzFeed gets major VC love, Amazon launches a mobile card reader, Netflix passes HBO, and more teens are familiar with PewDiePie than Johnny Depp. All this and more on The Drill Down. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription links are in our show notes. And if you do, leave us a review. We'd like to know what you think of our show. Facebook and Twitter.com at The Drill Down. Write to us at comments at The Drill Down. Our show is on Stitcher at Stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the hot topics of the show, we occasionally like to do a segment we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I gave the team an assignment over the last couple weeks to go see Guardians of the Galaxy so we could talk about it, because it is kind of a geek phenomenon. And as is our purview, it's something that I think that we should cover. So, but at this point, we've all seen Guardians of the Galaxy. I've seen it twice. I don't know if you guys seen it more than once, but let me ask you guys, what did you think of this? This has kind of been a phenomenon. This is the blockbuster movie of the summer.
Yeah, which is kind of surprising, because going into it, I didn't feel as though it would have been the blockbuster movie of the summer. You know, if you had asked me at the beginning of the summer which film would have come on top, and I definitely would not have suggested. Now, keep in mind, you know, Transformers still has, I believe, still has made more money than this film, as well as, I believe...
Yeah, Transformers is the biggest movie worldwide
that
over
is
the summer.
Kind of
yeah.
Crime.
And Ninja Turtles, I think, had overtaken this film last week as the top film in the box office. But regardless, when I saw the trailers, I thought this easily could be a very hit or miss film. Like, they could easily do it well, or it could be very flawed. But when I saw the film, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was quite the fun adventure. It was crowd pleasing. It had a lot of comedy, and it really brought a different universe feel to for Marvel, right? It wasn't based off the same sort of iconic characters that everyone knows. It brought a new cast, and in doing so, we saw that Marvel is still powerful enough that they could get lots of seats to the movies, and not only male individuals, but also females. The record number of women have turned out to watch this film, so. Seems to hit all the right buttons.
I think it does that by not chasing down some of the tropes in recent comic book movies. It's clear Marvel has deep banks, right? I mean,
yeah,
it's dominant now. You know, Marvel's dominating the comic book genre. When you look at it compared to DC Comics, DC's got Batman, Superman. Not many people are happy with Superman. You know, the films did a little well, but you know, Marvel's got X-Men, Spider-Man, the Avengers, you know, that's like their core set. And now Guardians of the Galaxy is going again deep into that bench with this whole different side of the universe. So that was definitely also changes the normal kind of comic book thing, because it's not necessarily about dark heroes, you know, these like people with dark pasts or whatever. Although, you know, Star-Lord has somewhat of a troubled past, but it's not sort of like I'm brooding because of the death of my parents in Batman, or I'm trying to live up to my father's legacy in Iron Man or whatever. Instead, it's kind of like I want to be cool, but I'm not cool, and my goofballiness is what you're going to like about me. That's kind of the sort of ragtag, Farscape feeling thing that I think this film has going for it.
Yeah, I think Marvel took a real risk here because it's not... I guess technically it's not a comic book movie as much as it is a... even though it's based on a comic book property, it's more of a space opera. And I think that's part of the thing that fired for me on all sort of different notes. To me, it really had a Star Wars vibe to it. You know, you've got your ragtag bunch of misfits who are thrown together, don't all necessarily like each other to begin with. You know, you've got your big sort of hulking character that doesn't speak much, and your wisecracking. You've got a couple of different wisecracking characters, and your female lead who also happens to be, you know, kick ass, somewhat like Princess Leia. But it just had an overall sort of 70s, 80s space opera feel to me, which is refreshing and something we haven't seen in a long time, even from George Lucas. We haven't seen
it. The 70s thing was definitely a nod to the generation that is paying money to see this movie.
Yeah.
The idea that growing up in the 80s, it just happens, some of the movie happens, you know, before the kind of millennial generation is there, but they can relate to it, right?
Yeah.
You get a good laugh at tapes and things. For me, I didn't feel Star Wars as much as I felt Firefly. Now, frankly, Star Wars has mysticism and sort of like, you know, this kind of religion that and this legendness, you know, the legend of the samurai with the religion of the Jedi and all that stuff.
More so fantasy.
There's
a
big mystic part. Yeah. And I think that while they tried to put a little bit of that in with these, you know, the kind of MacGuffin of the piece and the history behind that, they didn't really get into some of that more deep mysticism stuff. And I think that's good. It's good that they didn't do that. They kind of kept it light. I did feel, you know, the whole misfit, the whole thieving and all that stuff. It definitely felt like Firefly, which in itself, Firefly is effectively the story of what would have happened if Han Solo survived the loss of the Rebellion. If the Empire had won and the Rebellion was lost and Han Solo survived, that is all Firefly really is. So I think it's fitting that you feel Star Wars and I feel Firefly, because I think it draws heavily from both of those.
Or the beginning before A New Hope, when Han Solo was just a smuggler, right?
Yeah, too many people though. Han Solo was hanging out with Chewie by himself, messing with Jabba.
Either way, no matter how you slice it, I really love this movie. I love the you know, before I went in to see this movie, I would not have thought it would. I didn't think a CGI animated raccoon was going to work in the Marvel universe. I thought that this was going to be the movie that broke the Marvel streak.
It did come across as jumping the shark, that's for sure.
Yeah.
If you like, you know, I think right now as a sci-fi fan, there's a dearth of space opera to choose from, right? There's not a lot in the space opera world. What's it called? The Stargate is done. Star Trek has been over for a while. There's some new Star Trek, but frankly, if you're a fan of Star Trek, that the new stuff has fallen flat for a lot of people. Star Wars was a disappointment. And even though there's like some cartoony stuff, which is reasonable, the live action spaceships and laser gun stuff, there isn't a kind of established fantastic universe to kind of dream about right now that's being produced. And I think they did a very good job with that. I can't gush over the film. I think the characters could use some work and the writing was all right. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the universe that it was based in was pretty robust and fantastic. And then the special effects were also pretty, I would say, really well done. I wonder how they'll stand the test of time, but I definitely feel like I didn't feel like I was watching a film like Lord of the Rings where, you know, Legolas will jump on the back of some troll and it clearly looks like an animated thing jumped on the back of a troll, you know?
Sure.
It was very well defined. It felt very natural. And it was good. I didn't like so much the idea of this, you know, the Nova people with all the diversity were actually all the same type of person, just colored red and green. That really bothered me.
I guess you're right. I hadn't really thought about it.
It's like we have all these types of people, but they're really just all, you know, European people that we painted different colors.
Different colored Caucasians.
They could have had a couple Latin people, a couple Asian people in there. I don't know. Like, it came across as, I don't know. It came across as too reminiscent, perhaps, of what you'd find in a 70s movie.
Yeah.
You know, it lost relevance for me there.
I had not even thought about it. That's interesting until you just mentioned it right now.
Looking at movies that have been coming out this year with that and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
We've come a long way when it comes to, animated characters, right?
Yeah.
All of these characters feel so realistic and you just think of them as just another character or actor on the screen, which is pretty remarkable.
Do you think we should step up the awareness of digital actors?
No, I think we should step up the awareness of diverse actors. And if you want to throw digital in there, that's fine. But I think that we have a lot of... I mean, digital actors are going to show up more and more as the technology gets better. And eventually, I have a feeling that we'll see movies that are digitally with quote-unquote actors that don't exist in the real world and that travel from movie to movie. They're going to make characters like, an animated version of, let's call him Star-Lord. Uh-huh. And he will be in different films, and he will not have a human counterpart, just a voice. But because of the way we do movies, it's not going to feel like an animated film. It'll feel like a live-action film. And that's going to save a lot of money. And that's really where I think some of this is definitely going to go.
Do you feel like that... the digital actor in that the combination of both the animator and the motion capture actor, like Andy Serkis, for example, in the Planet of the Apes movie, are under awarded when it comes to? Yes.
Well, I don't know. I think right now we have a current framework for how we award movies.
Yeah.
And that framework was built before digital characterization
right.
is really a mainstream thing.
Do you think we need to reevaluate that framework so that we can include...
Yeah, we might have to reevaluate that framework, but I think there are some mechanisms wherein these people get recognized. You know, when you look at... I think there's going to be a great battle for the digital effects Oscar this year because of Guardians of the Galaxy and because of the Planet of the Apes film. What's going to win out? Is it going to be Andy Serkis? Is it going to be the raccoon? You know, my money's probably on Andy Serkis because he's got more street cred right now. But I would say that we have mechanisms for that. The movie industry doesn't change as quickly as, for instance, the Grammys, where they introduce new categories all the time based on a very rapid moving, musical zeitgeist. It's going to take a while before we really get, I also don't think that. I mean, like, do you want a best digital character actor, or do you want someone like Andy Serkis to get best actor? For me, I prefer the latter.
So I think, well, I have many strong opinions in here, and don't know if I will go into all of those. But I definitely agree that the movie industry is, or at least the award industry when it comes to films is lacking, and of course very political too.
Sure.
But this is the sort of change that should have happened a long time ago with performances like in Lord of the Rings with Gollum / Sméagol, and like this progression, the only place where I see people where I see these characters being rewarded is things like the MTV Movie Awards, right? In the broad stream.
Because those guys have to differentiate themselves from MTV Movie Awards is never going to be Oscar, right?
Right.
But
exactly.
The whole Academy Awards, so they differentiate themselves by looking at new categories, but they have influenced Oscar. The fact is, Oscar is the closest thing in America we have to a royal type tradition.
Yeah,
and because
but,
of that,
and
it
I
is
think
heavily
that's where it fails. I
sure,
think
but because but I'm saying you have to look at it from the perspective of more than I want these characters to have, you know, a category. It's what Oscar does is bigger than movies. What Oscar does is he gives America a sort of pageant show for what we have created as royals, which
and
are
I think
our
it's
stars.
A pageant
and because
that's
of that, it's
falsely
it's,
created.
It's, of course it is. All pageants are. All pageants are false. What I'm saying is it's focused on a relatively conservative look at how we value things. And because it's so focused on tradition, we don't have many, it's important that it has a status quo piece to it.
Yeah, and I think that status quo is what makes it such a failure, because movies are evolving
at a quick... I don't
think
you call it a failure.
Well, okay,
you call
well,
it a failure is a pretty big word to
okay,
call
that, most. That's a big word. How about a sham? I'm just kidding. That's also fairly large.
Disappointment, perhaps?
I would definitely say a disappointment, because, I mean, if you look at it, the movie industry, when it comes to movies, is adapting, changing, because technology is changing, right? And it hurts me to see that the industry that awards or the group that awards this industry fails to do so. And so when I think about these digital characters, I want us to not focus on just Andy Serkis being like the person who's doing it, but I want to also focus on the teams behind the creation of these
get recognized through the special effects. The special effects team is what wins that Oscar.
I mean, remember,
and right now, a digital character is a special effect. It's a camera trick. Is a camera trick. And if you want to differentiate that and segment it off, you'll have to come up with hard, concrete reasons to do so. And alongside those concrete reasons, you're going to have to come up with a plurality of films that use such characters in meaningful ways that justifies the addition of this type of character.
I think there are a plurality of films that do...
I don't hear it from you. I want these guys. I want it to be a thing, and they don't get respected and all this stuff. I need to hear actual tactics. Actual
list the movies. I mean, do you also what was that film that that in the end the animation industry or that had to basically wasn't getting paid?
It was Beauty and the Beast. I think you're referring to Beauty and the Beast was nominated for
Best Picture,
and because it didn't win, it influenced a change to have animation as its own separate category, feature-length animation as its own separate category. And I think that the time is right for a digital actor as well, and that would be the combination of both the motion capture, the voice actor, and the animation team that was specifically involved in the in animating the character.
Yeah, I mean, in general, if you recall, like films like Life of Pi, where we've noticed sort of such of a disregard for the studios that are behind the creation of these various graphics. Right, there was that whole there were all the protests and the whole hubbub around the entire. In the entire industry, where that company, I believe, went bankrupt.
Oh, you're talking about Life of Pi. That's right. Rhythm and Hughes.
Right. And so it's like, I find like, and that was just, that was not too long ago.
Nope.
It's kind of crazy that this still hasn't caused any sort of change. And I think that's really what jars me more about it, is like, we see all these things day in and day out, and it always takes... this royalty always takes such a long time to change, as well as, you know, similar in the royal.
If there's anything that I think we can agree on, it's that Northern California and its industries and Southern California and its industries do not get along. whether it's the distribution of media or the digitization and of characters in a film. And I think old media, even though they're using these digital characters, they need more before they can feel like they're going to need to add this new kind of character. And you guys are in a position to kind of wave the flag and say, look, let's get an award or recognition for this.
Well, and I think also I think the confluence of Silicon Valley and Hollywood is going to initiate
No, I think there's not going to be a confluence. Silicon Valley will drag Hollywood kicking and screaming to wherever it needs to go. Hollywood is an old media locked industry. They do not move forward. They get dragged forward. Like auto. Auto will be like Detroit will also get dragged kicking and screaming into the modern era by Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley will drag because it's going to have the power to. But the other guys, it's the reason why, you know, the cars went bankrupt and movies lost money for so long. It's because they weren't keeping up. And all Silicon Valley does is invent what's up to be kept up with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For a second, I thought you were going to say RoboCop is going to drag Detroit, dragging and screaming. I was kind of like, oh.
I will say, wrapping this up, that you know, for me, there are two seasons as far as I'm concerned in Hollywood, and that is blockbuster season and award season. And Guardians of the Galaxy was my favorite movie of blockbuster season. I think. We're going to have to wait till award season rolls in a month or so before we start seeing movies that are fundamentally better than this movie for me.
Yeah, so for me, it was up there, but it's currently Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Just Guardians was fun, and I had a great time, mm-hmm. but when you look at the deep meaning and yeah. everything in totality around that movie, it's really powerful.
Dawn is another good film, and I'd love for us to discuss that all as a group if we get a chance to all see that as well.
Yeah, I don't, for me, Guardians was fun. I could have caught it on video and been happy.
Oh,
it didn't blow me away.
You're killing me because the second time that I saw it in IMAX 3D, and the director James Gunn. Actually played with the IMAX format on certain scenes, so the format shifts during certain scenes, specifically tailored for those scenes.
Oh, last point. Yeah. I don't know if we're going to break into any spoilers here, but did you guys see the extra edition at the very end?
Yes.
Of the
film? Yes.
Yeah, so if you're going to see the film... to the end, and like most cases, Marvel throws an Easter egg back there, but we shouldn't say anything about it.
Yeah, but I thought it was brilliant, and I read the story behind it, and it was just really more of a joke and hilarious because it was funny. Like half the audience got it, or maybe a third of the audience, which was remaining there, got it. Sure. All the others was very confused, and like everyone else is explaining to everyone else who that was. So it was great.
Stay to
great
the stuff. End. Leave it yeah. to. suffice to say, stay to the end if you're going to see this movie, to the very bitter end after the credits. So,
I mean, Marvel just always does this.
Yeah,
if you're watching a Marvel film, finish it up.
It's part of it's part of sort of the trademark of this new Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I've seen Marvel use it in their marketing campaigns as well. Dwayne, you have also been playing with something this week that I've also had a chance to try myself.
Yeah, it's a Monument Valley. It's an iOS game. You play it on the iPhone, and yeah, it's about $4, and you kind of follow a princess, or you manipulate a princess, and she's basically trying to garner these stones or orbs or whatever. And it's very interesting, not because you're just the princess trying to find something, that's normal, but there's this kind of M.C. Escher look to the entire thing, and in fact,
yeah.
the player's role is to manipulate the universe, the artifacts in the universe, in order to get the character from A to B. And in order to do that, you have to think in that kind of Escher way. When you move a bridge over it, the perspective of it may not change, but it may connect with something that you thought was a level up or a level lower. So it has a lot of puzzles. It is a puzzle game, but unlike Two Dots, it's a fully 3D puzzle where you have to manipulate things that are not necessarily on the board. And so it's interesting, and it's a good way to kind of change your brain space, you know, if you got 5 minutes after, like, between like two things at work or whatever. So it's not bad.
Yeah, it's a beautifully designed. The art direction in this game is really well thought out and very it's got a very unique style. The music is amazing as well. It puts you in a good headspace playing this game. So, yeah, I highly recommend it. It's not a very long game. It's maybe like maybe your 11 or 12 levels. But it does have a concurrent story. There is sort of a narrative going through this game, which I don't know if you've experienced yet, Dwayne, where you are. But there's definitely a little bit of a narrative going through there. And it's worth the $4. All right. Let's get into the headlines of this week. So this is a story that completely skipped, missed me on the radar until you pointed it out, Dwayne. But Samsung announced the Galaxy Alpha this week, which is a new smartphone with a metal frame. It's ultra thin, 6.7 millimeter. It's an Android phone, of course, with a 4.7 inch 720p display, 12 megapixel camera, a small battery, and depending on where you are, a quad or octa-core processor. It'll be available in September, but Samsung has yet to announce pricing for this. But it's very reminiscent of what we've been seeing a sneak through of the iPhone 6, although we haven't seen any official shots of the iPhone 6. A lot of what's rumored to have to be actually the iPhone 6 from tech vendors looks very similar to the style that Samsung is presenting with the Galaxy Alpha.
You know, in terms of its look and feel, it has a pretty high quality feel for a mm-hmm. Galaxy device, which is usually made of plastic. While the Samsung Galaxy S5 comes across as kind of a utility device with its plastic and its waterproofness and everything like that being big marketing features, the Galaxy Alpha is a very, very refined, possibly more elegant piece of hardware. But there are trade-offs for that. And one of those is the lack of power when you compare it to the upcoming iPhone 6 or the Galaxy S5. Samsung is looking for what they said is a phone to suit the needs of the consumer market. And I think when you get the Galaxy 5, it very much has a reputation of kind of being that everything in the kitchen sink thrown in. So this is a way more kind of lifestyle-centric phone, or I guess daily driver type of phone with the 720p display instead of Samsung's 1920 display, with the processor running a little slower than what's going on in the Galaxy mm-hmm. S5. So it's not a flagship, but it's a close second. And I think that's pretty interesting.
This reminds me a little bit of, and maybe I'm off base here, but you know, when Windows and the Mac operating systems were first launched, they were both graphical user interfaces, but they were so vastly different from each other that they it was worth noting. But as time went on, they moved closer and closer to each other until around the Vista era, they were virtually indistinguishable until Mac made some changes and Windows made some changes, and now they've forked off again, although I suspect they're going to come together to be very similar again. But this is kind of what I feel about the design style of these phones these days, is we're all heading toward a unified design feel with Samsung and the iPhone until they're pretty much indistinguishable from each other.
I feel like that's true until, you know, someone gets sued for trade dress violation.
Right, which has already happened.
Right, I mean, Samsung, I think, did a very good job of moving away from the Apple look and feel with the Galaxy S 3, 4, and 5. Galaxy Alpha moves back in that direction. But if you're going to have one phone look like Apple instead of all your phones looking like Apple, then there's a thing. Apple hasn't changed its style in quite some time. The 5 series looks like an updated version of the 4 series.
Yeah.
Rather than the kind of complete changeover between, you know, original iPhone and iPhone and the iPhone 3G and 3GS, which was a big jump, and then another big jump between the 3G and 3GS and the iPhone 4. We're getting into an incremental space here, and I think that's helpful for both Apple to focus on what they want to do and for users to feel comfortable with the design language that they use, mm-hmm. While Samsung kind of is a bit more bold, and there's something there too. Google as well is a bit more bold. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how these stack up. Obviously, you know, it's the middle of August.
Right.
Apple's phone's supposed to come out
September.
In middle September. So there is a kind of, let's call it a push here.
Yeah.
To make sure that Samsung isn't found irrelevant, that they have lots of options for their users once this iPhone shows up in stores.
It does feel like there's a little bit of a... I mean, everyone's pushing towards getting stuff out before Christmas, obviously.
Yeah.
We've heard similar rumors about Apple's iWatch offering as well being announced during this mid-September announcement that they've got coming up.
Yeah, it's a toy announcement, maybe.
All right, moving on here. This week, Amazon announced Amazon Local Register, a credit card reader and app combination that they hope to compete with the Square and PayPal's offerings. The difference is they're going to be offering a flat charge of 1.75% per payment until the beginning of 2016, which will the fee will rise to 2.5%, which is still a smaller, a significant cut compared to Square and PayPal. So it's a credit card reader and an app that is going to be undercutting the payment fees of Square and PayPal. So already that's a huge advantage that Amazon will have coming in.
They've got an uphill battle here.
You don't think they got the advantage because of the Amazon name? You think this is still because of
that's
Square?
That's the uphill battle. Amazon has been taking money out of the pockets of local retailers for 10 years. What local retailer wants to have Amazon run its POS system, its point-of-sale system? When you're a local retailer and you're selling the same things that Amazon sells, and maybe you have a couple products that Amazon doesn't sell. But you know what? You're going to put those products in the inventory on this new system.
Sure.
And then Amazon will suddenly know how many units of whatever product you're selling. That'll allow Amazon on its retail side, on its website, to source that product, find it, and offer it cheaper than you do. This is a situation where retailers don't have the right incentive necessarily to hop in here, because it could mean getting boxed out later on once Amazon figures out your game, your tactics,
but
your ingredients to the success of your business.
You still can't buy tacos or neck massages on Amazon.
That's true. I'll give you that. You can't buy a neck massage. You can't buy tacos on Amazon yet. But I will say that when it comes to, private mom and pop retailers, like a sports athletic store or any other kind of goods store, you know, the lower money and percentage you're paying to Amazon may not be helpful in the long term as they learn what it is you're selling, how well you're selling it, and they begin putting that stuff in the warehouses, you know, in your surrounding area, so people can get that stuff same day delivered.
Oh, that's interesting. I am sort of curious, you know, how many of those smaller stores will think about those long-term implications versus the short-term gains. The one thing which is interesting to me, I think, is actually more so with Square and I believe also PayPal. They give you their devices for free, and Amazon's actually charging you. I know it's cheap, right? It's $10, but that's still $10.
Well, yeah. So Amazon sells it by saying, "Hey, look, it's $10 for you to buy it, but it's no money for you to use it."
Right.
I mean, it's less money for you to use it.
Less by a percentage until they up it to where it's less by 0.2%, I think, after some period of time.
After, 2016.
Right. And so I guess that's the sort of curiosity there. Like, someone who already has, Square, are you going to a business? So, for example, I have Square, right? I have some of the I have their device. But I'm not a business, so I don't use it on a regular basis. So I wouldn't go out of my way to, spend $10 to get the Amazon thing. But as a business, would you look at it? The other interesting thing that I know Square has been moving towards is, given that cards are, credit cards in the U.S. Are switching from swiping to ones where you just tap to RFID.
Sure, it's the little chip that's embedded inside the cards.
Right, for security reasons. Mm-hmm. I know that Square has been sending messages about how their plans for the future and how they want to make that transition faster and smoother. You know, I assume Amazon has their head to the wind on that sort of thing, but you know, I'm seeing more action in that sort of space. Because the other thing with Amazon is, you know, they, although this runs somewhat in line with their business, they are spread around, similar to you know, Google, right?
Yeah.
And so are they going to really be able to put enough, are they going to dedicate enough of a presence to really understand that market and do what's proper for it?
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to, you know, these type of payments, or are they more trying to secede beyond it where they're the primary manufacturer, which, you know, that's where those long-term concerns also come into play.
Yeah, I feel like this is a – I mean, Amazon should get into this space. There's no doubt that this is one of the things that they – one of, like, this year has been a big year of expansion with telephones and Fire TV devices and this kind of technology. When you look at Amazon's Q2 statements, you realize they have lost some money because they've been expanding to these places. But they have a mission. That mission is to allow people to find the best stuff around and get it quickly and at the best cost possible. And this is a clear, focused way to do that. That goes along with their revenue plan, yeah. And I think it's a smart move for them. I do think that they're going to have an uphill battle getting it into these stores and stuff. They've also had, you know, they've had an uphill battle with other traditional businesses like publishing. So we'll see how well it does. I don't know that people are going to want to switch from one thing to the other unless you are a taco stand and you are feeling the pinch of this 3% that Square charges you.
Yeah, I do like your speculation, and I believe that I have no reason to doubt that that's true, that Amazon will be using all of this data to supplement what they sell online. So it's just a smart thing for them to do. Speaking of small businesses, so Lyft and Uber this week.
Uber is a $17 billion business.
Yeah, but they started off as a small startup. Yep. They've increased exponentially over the last year. It's amazing. But Lyft this week said that many Uber employees have tried to sabotage drivers working for Lyft, according to data that Lyft shared with CNN. They say that 177 Uber employees have requested and quickly canceled more than 5,000 rides from Lyft drivers over the past 10 months in an effort to frustrate Lyft's customers and drivers. On Tuesday, Uber, they threw their own accusations at Lyft, saying that Lyft's own drivers and employees, including one of Lyft's founders, have canceled 12,900 trips on Uber. So these guys are in an intense rivalry up in the taxi and transportation industry, and both have resorted to increasingly cutthroat tactics in order to beat the other in the push for new customers and loyal drivers.
Mm.
It's I have not used either of these, but it does.
Oh,
seem,
haven't you? They're,
no,
they're interesting.
No.
I have. You know what's funny about this? I haven't found every time I get in a car with an Uber driver, they tend to also be a Lyft driver.
I didn't know you could double dip as a driver.
So you can't double dip on that one trip, but if you're driving around and there's not enough volume on Lyft or Uber individually, yeah, you have two phones, each of them running the situation. I've only seen it done with two phones. I suppose you could do it with one. And what ends up happening is, you know, they pick up the next closest person, whether it's on Lyft or whether it's an Uber.
I'm surprised that both companies haven't effected some sort of contract where you can't, if you're working for one, you can't work for the other.
So they basically just go out of their car and stick on a mustache on there and then pick someone up, or?
I mean, I've been picked up by an Uber driver with a mustache on his car. Like,
wow.
I don't think they care that much.
Really? Interesting.
I don't think they care that much. I think that they care insofar as a...
revenue, right?
Yeah, revenue. Like they'll take the mustache off if it becomes a problem. I think they don't care. It's just a question of laziness. I put it on there for Lyft. Let me take it off for Uber. Yada, yada, yada. It's kind of not one of those things where I think the drivers actually care. For, to them, it's all just transportation. They don't care, you know. I mean, I'm sure that this one rate might be better than another rate, you know, Uber during peak period, yada, yada, yada. But I think when it comes to just, like, trying to get 8 hours of driving in and make your money, they just want to pick up fares if they can.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in Uber several times. I've used it on multiple occasions, and it's actually all been fairly – it's been really good. You know, nice drivers, nice rides. The technology behind it just makes life very simple. I know people who have success with
– And it's not like amazing technology is the funny part.
No, it's very
– like it's one of those ideas which time had come because all the technologies were – available to it, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but it wasn't like they figured out something that was the most spectacular use of whatever. I mean, that's the best part about Uber. It just kind of makes sense.
Yeah, taxis could totally do something like this too.
They should have done something like it a long time ago.
And I think some of them are starting to pivot in that sort of direction.
Right
now,
and
of course,
you've got
having
the go ahead.
Yeah, you have the protections that come around taxis. Of course, having the ability to not have to dig out a card and have it automatically pay for it is an additional benefit.
Mm-hmm.
What I will say is that I think the money behind them sort of justifies the existence, because as we kind of talked about, you know, the innovator's dilemma, right?
Right.
This is kind of a pure example of that small upstart coming in and forcing you to innovate, or at least attempting to. We'll see what the government says in this jurisdiction. But it's also very interesting that, you know, both of these companies have a sense that, you know, they really are – they're participating in the sort of same network – in the same category, right?
Right.
So you think about it, same thing with like – cloud providers, right? Before, there were only a few cloud providers, be it for personal or even for enterprise, and now in the number has really skyrocketed, and so there's that.
Yeah. Well, they need each other, because they're not gonna, unless they have each other to compete against, they're not going to move forward.
Yeah,
right?
They'll stagnate.
Box needs Dropbox, Apple needs Samsung, Lyft needs Uber, Coke needs Pepsi.
And the other thing is, by having one another, they have a better chance of pushing, you know, legislature and change that will allow them to operate.
Yeah.
Either way, I think the two of them together are going to completely upend the transportation industry, the transportation for hire industry, I should say.
Well, until the robots take it over.
Until self-driving cars. And then the game is completely off.
Mm-hmm.
All right, moving on here. Where are we? Okay. Edward Snowden. Okay, so former NSA contractor and whistleblower Edward Snowden was interviewed in Russia this week by James Banford, a NSA whistleblower himself, for Wired magazine. This is a fascinating article. It's a long 7 or 8 page article in Wired. It really sort of digs into, for the first time, I think this is the first time that we've really gotten a personal look at Edward Snowden's motivations behind the stuff that he's done and a little bit of his background itself. Amongst in the article, amongst the biographical stuff that he's talked about himself and about why he did the stuff that he did, there were a couple of new revelations out of this interview, first of which was that the TAO, which is division of NSA hackers that are devoted to targeted operations, attempted in 2012 to remotely install an exploit in one of the core routers of a major internet service provider in Syria, which was during their civil war. This would have given the NSA access to email and other internet traffic from much of the country, but something went wrong and the router was bricked instead, which rendered it totally inoperable. And the failure of that router caused Syria to suddenly lose all connection to the internet. And I remember when this happened, I think we even discussed it on the drill down, the Syrian internet outage. And up until now, the public did not know that the U.S. government was responsible. It's interesting. And he talks about how in the TAO operations center, they had the NSA had what he calls their an oh shit moment as they raced to remotely repair the router to cover their tracks and prevent the Syrians from finding out that it was them that had planted this bogus router, this hacked router. Fortunately for the NSA, the Syrians were apparently more focused on restoring the nation's internet than tracking down the cause of the outage. And he says that back at the TAO operations center, the tension was broken with a joke that contained more than a little truth. If we get caught, we can always point the finger at Israel. So, ouch. The other big revelation in this article is that there's a new cyber warfare program in the works codenamed MonsterMind, which would automate the process of hunting for the beginnings of a foreign cyber attack. The software would be constantly on the lookout for traffic patterns indicating known or suspected attacks. When it detects an attack, MonsterMind would automatically block it from entering the country, which is considered a kill in cyber terminology. But the interesting thing about this is that there are a lot of other programs that do this sort of thing that block attacks from getting into the country. Essentially killing the cyber attack. But MonsterMind is a little different because instead of simply detecting and killing the malware, it will automatically fire back with no human involvement, which Snowden said is a problem because initial attacks are often routed through computers in innocent third countries. And the attacks can be spoofed. So you can have someone sitting in China, for example, making it appear that one of these attacks is originating in Russia. And then we end up through MonsterMind shooting back at a Russian hospital. In addition to the possibility of accidentally starting a war, Snowden views MonsterMind as the ultimate threat to privacy because in order for it to work, the NSA first would have to secretly get access to virtually all private communications coming in from overseas to people in the U.S. And that means violating the Fourth Amendment, seizing private communications without a warrant, without probable cause or even suspicion of wrongdoing for everyone all the time.
It's kind of interesting where Snowden, you know, this is finally like a good look into, you know, his life and, mm-hmm. and more of his history and less of, you know, oh, this is the facts we've dug up and more of the actual man telling the story on his own and sharing insights. So it's a very good article, and I'd suggest people taking a read through it. But one of the things that I kind of found sort of compelling about it is sort of how Snowden's also become more than, you know, it's kind of cliche to say it, but become more than a man, right? He is now sort of a figure, like V for Vendetta, right? Like that actual character where, one of the things that was noted in the article, how there's been several other releases that don't seem to be anywhere within Snowden's within the documents that Snowden provided. The various organizations are mainly probably leaked by other by other routes, but they're choosing to do it under, you know, this name, right? Sort of like anonymous, right? Sort of like this bigger. I just found that kind of interesting and unique.
Yeah, they speculated that there's more than one source other than Snowden for all of these leaks, and the people who do hold the cache of data currently, which is the Guardian, New York Times, and a couple of other sources, are all keeping mum about who that other, or even if a definitive answer of. If there is another source, which is another interesting revelation from this article.
This idea that, you know, Snowden is tucked away in Russia so we can use his name for any leaks we have to get the government to scrutinize us less about our sources is a really effective one. Mm-hmm. I who wouldn't want to use that, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe in 70 years, Snowden will still be used, despite the fact that he, you know, at that point he'd be 100.
Roberts.
Yeah, so it's kind of like it's a great mystery. It's an interesting way to look at it, and I look at the Syria thing, and it's very movie spy conspiracy, and it's, you know, it doesn't give us a lot of confidence about the way the world really works. And that's kind of like how I feel about the whole Snowden thing. Like my confidence in the way the world really works has been somewhat shattered.
Edward Snowden really was our modern version of the collective loss of innocence of this country. In the same way that it was when the resignation of President Nixon for that era.
Right. There's a certain like, you know, the cat's out of the bag now kind of thing going on. I would also liken it to Ronald Reagan and the Iran-Contra affair.
Sure.
This idea that the president could lie, the government is lying. All those things like Nixon, Iran-Contra, Pentagon Papers, Snowden. The government is lying to us because it has interests that it doesn't think we can handle. And I think that's part of the problem. Not everything could be out there. Not everything could be available for public consumption, especially the technologies used to surveil, you know, enemies of this country. That's like the one thing I think Snowden will have a bad rap for indefinitely. But at the same time, I think you're right about this kind of loss of innocence. We've been running around jolly in the information technology space for the last 15, 20 years. It's only gotten better and better and better. And I think that part of the issue here is that we didn't realize the compromises that could happen, the consequences of living in that world, because our culture was still new to it. Well, now that we're a bit more grown up, I think it's important to think about other cultures and how they're going to deal with this kind of technology and whether it's appropriate for them. There might be like a prime directive kind of thing that we need to think about when it comes to using technology with other cultures. Because like, look at the growing pains we're going through.
Right. Serious soul searching, collective soul searching that we'll all have to be doing from here on out. All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And this week, we lost a great talent. Robin Williams, as you know, died this week on August 11th. And it was obviously a man whose talents were a tremendous influence across many different media and many different generations. And I'd like to just honor his memory by selecting an Audible book that he has personally narrated, which is a kid's story, Pecos Bill, which is, Pecos Bill is a Wild West legend. An American original legend, Robin Williams narrates this story with his own take on Pecos Bill, as if Pecos Bill was as if he was reading firsthand as Pecos Bill. It's entertaining, but it's a nice sort of takeaway to have a memory of the man, this tremendous talent.
I live a block and a half away from the house in Mork and Mindy. And it's kind of been a zoo ever since he passed.
Wow.
You know, it's, there's like basically vigil type stuff going on there. And he was a big deal for me, you know, my mom introduced me to some of his material when I was probably younger than I should have been. Like Good Morning Vietnam when I was like a little kid, because she thought it was so powerful. And it's a loss. And I think that we need to take a look at in this country about being more open about our feelings so that we can do things like recognize depression and do something about it before it turns into this kind of thing.
Yeah. I think Robin Williams was really a powerful figure. He lived in Northern California here, but a powerful figure all around the world, as you can kind of see from all the outreaching, as well as even, you know, the various technology spheres. You know, Apple had a tribute for him on their site, and they rarely do that for anyone, right? So,
no one didn't like him. There are plenty of comedians, people like, I don't really care, but no one didn't like Robin Williams.
Yeah, I think he touched a lot of people a lot more than you know they initially would have recognized. For me, it's definitely a sad moment, a sad passing. I definitely agree with Dwayne in your thoughts of making sure that we use this moment also to understand the, you know, other individuals who are maybe going through similar sort of plights and focus on helping them as well too. But you know, it's I think it's a good time to go revisit some of his, some of the things that he's done, some of the films and other ways he's touched people over the years, and enjoy it. He still has several new movies that will be coming out in the, in the next few years. I believe it's like four titles or so. So we'll still have some more new Robin Williams memories to treasure.
Well, that'll be nice. Anyway, to download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the chance to check out their service. Using that URL helps us out on the show, so please do that. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can cancel it and you still get to keep that book for free. We're going to take a break here, listen to some music, and when we return, what you watch and how you watch it is changing for the better. Take a listen to this and come on back.
When Alibaba had them 40 thieves, Sherazade had 1,000 tales. Master, you in luck, cause up your sleeves, you got a brand of magic never fails. You got some power in your corner now, heavy ammunition in your camp. You got some punch, pizzazz, Yahoo and how, see, all you gotta do is rub that lamp. And I'll say, Mr. Alonzo, what will your pleasure be? Let me take your order, jot it down. You ain't never had a friend like me. Life is your restaurant, and I'm your manager. Come on, whisper what it is you want. You ain't never had a friend, never had a friend. You ain't never had a friend, never had a friend. You ain't never had a friend like me. You ain't never had a friend like me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the Roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakan. Emmy nominations aren't the only place where Netflix is beginning to eat HBO's lunch. The streaming video service just edged past HBO on the subscription revenue front last quarter, earning $1.146 billion to the cable network's $1.14 billion. That is a small margin. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings posted the news to Facebook, noting that his company is still behind when it comes to profits and Emmys, but, quote, we're honored to be in the same league. He added, yes, I loved Silicon Valley, and yes, it hits a little close to home. So this is a landmark for Netflix. It's, you know, we've seen them get up to the plate with the Emmys and be solid contenders for Netflix. I mean, with HBO. And now we're seeing a little bit more in this space with the subscription revenue, which is obviously, you know, the Netflix's bread and butter. That's their bottom line.
This to me is a relatively big deal for a couple of reasons. One, you know, Netflix has been on the scene for maybe 15 years now, right? HBO has been on the scene for close to 30. So right. They've caught up in a pretty quick amount of time. There's also this idea that even though they've just edged past HBO's revenue, they've already gotten the prestige, and HBO's already said we have to become Netflix before Netflix becomes HBO.
Right.
Well, someone's knocking on the door. Look in your rearview mirror. Objects are closer than they appear, HBO, right? So you have that. And it may be the kind of push that we need that needs to exist in order for HBO to begin thinking about opening up HBO Go subscriptions beyond people who are subscribing to cable. There are plenty of reasons why HBO wouldn't open up HBO Go subscriptions to people who don't pay for the cable service. Many of which involve the fact that, you know, they're getting a lot of money from cable companies right now. They don't need that extra revenue. But in the PR space, if Netflix has become bigger than HBO in terms of subscription revenue, that shows, hey, it's an easy way to open up the pot. And frankly, there are a lot of people who will that have Netflix who will spend another $15 a month just for you. This is one of the things that we have to contend with when we think about Comcast purchasing Time Warner, which owns HBO. The kind of market forces that are happening right now with Netflix leave us in a place where we can ponder HBO wanting to go the Netflix route for some of its content. Even though they just made a big deal with Amazon. Now, if Comcast buys Time Warner, then these market forces don't matter because it's such a monopoly that they can avoid the market, right? They can just kind of dictate terms. And that's what we have to deal with. So it's an interesting thing, I think, for those two reasons. Netflix is rushing to catch up with HBO. The amount of Netflix original series that come up on my screen have tripled since they began, or quadrupled maybe, right? And it's high quality stuff. It's not junky stuff. There's always something. They want to make something for everyone, and I get that. But a lot of it is the kind of thing where it's like suspense and drama, and it's got relatively universal appeal for adults. And I mean, that's a big deal. And HBO, you know, the warning shot wasn't across the bow. The warning shot basically grazed the side of the ship with this one. So this is significant.
I have to tell you personally that I would definitely pay for HBO Go as a standalone product. So
yeah, I mean it's
the
it's,
market's it's, there.
Yeah.
Yeah, the market is definitely there with the shows that they have available and the new ones. Like, I mean, True Detective, right? That's some quality TV. The problem is, or at least what I see as something, the problem is HBO produces a lot of quality shows, but they only produce so much, while Netflix has this wide variety of content that's available to users at any point of time, right? So
for Netflix, how long though? So Netflix stuff, like HBO's content catalog is consistent. They own the content, so it doesn't expire. Stuff comes and goes from Netflix. You're not going to find, like, you used to be able to watch Avatar The Last Airbender on Netflix. You can't find that there anymore. They removed it.
Right.
So there's something to that. And the quality of the stuff and the brand that HBO's built allows HBO to say, hey, give me $15 and you can have everything I've ever done.
That's true. But HBO, you know, HBO does silently remove things that maybe potentially are less performing, as well as HBO. I don't necessarily know why this is, but I do know, you know, I had a friend who was watching True Detective and noticed that, hey, it has this expiration time for the show, and then it did disappear from HBO Go as well as from the TV because I had noticed similar things. Now, it was put back up a little bit later, but there was still that sort of odd, you know, hey, why did this suddenly disappear and what's going on? I don't know what their model is. But yeah, I know
with movies and stuff, they have an expiration date. So I'm going to rescind part of my earlier statement. With movies, there's an expiration date. But with their content, I haven't seen that. So I'm not familiar with what happened with True Detective. But
yeah,
I
mean, it did come back. Maybe it's just the same sort of programmatic idiom, and they just hadn't extended it. But I will say what, you know, I have HBO Go, I've got Netflix, I've got Amazon Prime, and the one station that I tend to return to every sort of day is Netflix, because, you know, sometimes I just want to watch a light show, like, or quote-unquote light show like The Clone Wars or something animated.
Sure.
I don't always want to watch something that's – most of HBO's content that I really enjoy is fairly heavy.
It's deep and brooding, yeah. I mean, for me, HBO, the stuff that I like is the comedy stuff. I do like Veep. I do like the John Oliver show. I do like that kind of thing. But I feel that they've been around for so long and they have such a large catalog of content that they can compete not as, hey, I'm an Amazon Prime Netflix rival, but more like, I am the premium channel, period. If you want the premium channel with a streaming subscription, great. Now that's offered to you. I don't have a lot of stuff, but the stuff I have is very good, and it's just sitting there waiting for you. Now, this is clearly complicated by the fact that Amazon made a deal with HBO to get some of their legacy titles, The Sopranos and some other things. So if you have an Amazon Prime account, if you're an Amazon Prime user, you do have access to some of those older HBO stuff. But I mean, HBO, it has, you know, comes out with new stuff every year, and that, you know, the legacy stuff is what's on Amazon. So if you want to catch up, great. But if you want to keep up, there's room here for HBO to jump into that space. And I think that, you know, here's the thing, Tosin. They can jump into that space, and even if they have, you know, let's call it 1% of their subscribers are HBO Go people, you know, are HBO Go people, Go only, let's call them, then they've still gained subscribers. You know, I don't know how many people are going to jump off of Comcast because HBO has HBO Go. I know that people who have Comcast and pay for HBO might also pay for Showtime, might also pay for other things. So they don't want HBO alone. But I do know that there's a significant amount of people who are just getting into, you know, coming out of college, getting into their own apartments, houses and stuff. And they would pay for Comcast and then they would pay separately for HBO Go.
Yes, I agree.
And that incremental growth right there, because the cost of having HBO Go happen, you know, having the service out there, that's already covered by the existing user base. And the fact that we know for a fact via relatively recent articles with the you know, the president CEO has been interviewed, that he doesn't care if people share passwords.
Right.
Now, what if you began caring that people shared passwords but said, hey, for $15 a month, you get it all anyway? I mean,
yeah,
that's revenue. That's profit right there. The only thing holding them back now is the other cable companies they work with giving them pressure not to do that by giving them more money and saying, hey, don't do that, please. Don't do that, please. We don't want to become dumb pipes. Netflix is breaking the mold. Netflix is as powerful as iTunes was when music started being sold digitally. It represents a fundamentally new model, and I think Reed Hastings has done a fantastic job not only of founding the company but running the company. I mean, there were times when everyone called for him to step down. He said, no, I got this, guys. Mm-hmm. He had the stumble with Quickster, and that was that was the stumble. But really, like, let's face it, how many founders do we know were able to successfully
bounce back from something like that?
Yeah, bounce back from that kind of thing, or just successfully truly run the company well, mm-hmm. you know? Google famously said, look, we're not ready to be running this huge company. We're going to put Eric Schmidt while we figure it out. And they did that. And that matters.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think Netflix is doing a fantastic job. I'm happy to be a subscriber. And it is the number one used app on my Apple TV. There's no doubt.
Yeah, no, I agree that for HBO, there clearly is a place for them. They do have very good content. And they have shown the ability to always, to at least constantly, within the last, I don't know, 20 so years, continually provide excellent content. It's just, you know, I think they still have some more pivoting to do. I think there's space for both of them. And as a consumer, I'm happy that all these other places have such quality content so that, you know, if I ultimately find that Netflix doesn't suit my needs, there are others in that same sort of vein. And I
Amazon
don't necessarily
Prime.
Need have to stick with, you know, the legacy content providers. Same thing. The question is, who's going to pivot faster? Will it be TV or taxis?
Yeah, that's a good question.
They're all being – see, this is what my point was about, so, like, you know, Northern California. They're being subsumed by technology. What we call technology is, simply put, the digitization and free flow of information for services that thrived on availability of information. Right, taxis were all about, oh, I don't know where the taxi is. I guess I'm going to wait here. And Uber's like, no, why don't you not wait there? Why don't you do something else and wait for the car will come when you're ready for it to come. And that's getting in the way of taxis. Television, I mean, that's been a fight that's been happening ever since the dawn of the internet, TV and music and movies, you know. And Netflix figured out a model that works. Netflix's biggest challenge is having the content providers say, hey, look, your model's working and you're taking in money, but we want more of it. So yeah. Our subscriptions go up and up and up. That's like the thing that I think we have to worry about the most.
I think as a consumer, these are good times because it just means more choice and more competition.
Now, if only somebody could come out with a box that has access to the Google Play Store and the Amazon Store, and like, you know, Netflix and HBO Go
and
all
iTunes.
At once. You're never gonna get iTunes.
You're never gonna get iTunes.
Yeah, you're never gonna get iTunes. So that's one of the, and that's one of those things that Apple is really interesting about. I actually, with the exception of the Disney movies I buy through the Disney app, I don't buy a lot of stuff on iTunes because I don't know if I'll be able to watch it should I decide to leave the platform. Yeah. Right? That's a that's I don't want to be hooked in that way. So that's why Amazon is attractive for the purchase of video content.
All right, moving on here. This is an interesting story here. BuzzFeed just closed a new $50 million investment from Andreessen Horowitz, the prominent venture capital firm in Silicon Valley. The investment values the company at about $850 million. BuzzFeed's new cash infusion will be used to make several major changes, including introducing new content sections, creating an in-house incubator for new technology and potential acquisitions, and putting far more resources towards BuzzFeed Motion Pictures, its LA-based video arm. Still, the company faces the same problem that more traditional publications do, as in rates for traditional online advertising have dropped consistently from year to year. And to keep up, sites must either perpetually increase traffic at a steady clip or innovate and move into new and potentially more lucrative areas like native advertising and video. Already, most of BuzzFeed's revenue is derived from BuzzFeed Creative, the company's 75-person unit dedicated to creating for brands custom video and list-style advertising content that looks similar to its own editorial content. And we've discussed native advertising. I think we talked about native advertising a couple of episodes ago when John Oliver posted a video on his Last Week with John Oliver show that highlighted native advertising, and in particular BuzzFeed's take on it. And it's interesting that BuzzFeed, which is has always been sort of in my mind a very light, frothy, list-oriented, not very hard news site.
Oh, BuzzFeed is very hard news. They have hard, hard political journalism. They are on they have correspondents that show up on MSNBC, CNN. They're very big into political news. Absolutely. This other stuff effectively subsidizes their mainstream elite news efforts. And that's one of the big things here. Chris Dixon said, look, native advertising is the future when it comes to content, because otherwise you can't pay for content. And what they're doing is they're making that money. So we think we're going to get back a lot on this investment. They give them $50 million. That allows them to focus on the video production content that gets wildly viral all over the net. It allows them to focus on the, getting more of that native advertiser content right there. The listicles that you were talking about, it's unclear which ones are theirs and which ones are native advertising sometimes, which is not necessarily good if you're an advertiser, but people go to the site because of that. And in the end, when you see the kind of reporting that they've done, I mean, they've uncovered some significant stories in the last couple of years. They have a really legitimate news arm, and the only thing that I think the only mistake I've ever seen I think that they may have made is not calling that news arm something other than BuzzFeed, because we have regular people who may not be political news junkies like I am,
sure,
who are like, oh, BuzzFeed does other types of news too, and that's something that's getting in the way of the penetration of that particular content.
Yeah, I'll admit that's kind of my take on BuzzFeed. Is they're certainly not on my radar for their hard news at all.
Yeah, you know what the most interesting thing about BuzzFeed for me is actually their video arm, because I've seen them do some creative things with that, and I think that's where there's a good amount of expansion that they have as potential. Because I definitely do think it is a little worrisome, based off of the bracket that a lot of people just defaultly lump them into, right? People just lump them into the lists. That the article that we
that's where they make
is
a lot of their bread and butter, right?
Yeah, but that's true. But is that enough to keep sustained for revenue when it comes to that point, right?
Yeah. So when it comes to native advertising, those lists get sponsored, and that's where the revenue comes in. Less on ads and more of the sponsorship of that stuff. So you'll find a list, 25 greatest kittens, and it's sponsored by Purina. But right, because kittens are big and because lists are an incredibly powerful journalistic tool to draw people in, you're going to get a lot of viewers, and that Purina is going to get exposed a lot more than it may have if it's just part of AdSense, or if it's trying to do a takeover on the New York Times, takeover being the big banner you see on maybe the New York Times or whatever. What the native advertising does is it creates a bit of content that is particularly relevant to the advertiser. So rather than getting shot with a bunch of interruptive ads that make your web page take a million years to load and get in the way of what you want to read, it effectively says, you know, this is sponsored by these guys. They have whatever product about kitties. And you're like, oh, I'll check that out maybe. And they get better engagement off of that. So to answer your question, Tosin, the listicles, they work very well. I mean, Forbes, Sirius, you know, financial magazine is focused on listicles as well.
Well, I think it's the BuzzFeed influence. I mean, BuzzFeed, the success of the listicles and the light entertainment viral news has influenced the entire industry across the board. And it wasn't. I mean, BuzzFeed wasn't isn't patient zero in this case, but they certainly are the most known for it.
Yeah, I mean they really have gotten out there, and the thing about listicles especially is that they're fantastic SEO, right?
Oh yeah, I mean yeah.
So that's a big piece of it as well. But yeah, BuzzFeed is, you know, I think they're worth $1 billion? I mean, I don't know. $850 million, almost $1 billion. I don't know that half of what I've seen that sold for $1 billion feels like it's worth $1 billion, but you know, who am I? I'm just Dwayne, right? But I think it's a good good indication of where the journalism is going. I don't know if we should be proud of where it's going, but
that's the thing that really is the real conflict for me is, should I be happy about this? You know, I'm happy for BuzzFeed, but is this going to cause the total degradation of journalism online? Is awarding BuzzFeed for creating these listicles, giving them money to make them more powerful, is that going to affect overall, you know, systematically online journalism?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we say the same thing about everything, right?
I think there's legitimacy here. We say the same thing about lots of things because we know that when you tie the storytelling to financials, the storytelling can in some ways be compromised in its objectivity. I mean,
that is true, but I mean,
that's concerning. It's not saying we're not Luddites. We're not just saying, oh, there's no, you shouldn't change anything. You're saying that, like, we know that's why John Oliver had his big thing, because we know that when you start putting money behind, you know, what's supposed to be objective journalism, that can get in the way of objective journalism. You're no longer objective.
But isn't it the audience to determine what they now see as the, you know, source of truth? Like, isn't that the sort of thing that people have to decide if, you know, whether or not Fox News is where they want to get their news, or CNN or BBC or any other
site?
So
I would say that,
right?
Fox, I think we agree that Fox News may not be an objective source of news all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the issue, right? They know that if they target the politics of a certain demographic, they'll do, you know, they'll grab that audience and they'll be compelled to what's it called, to follow their show. So, you know, I don't think that Fox is lacking a ton of journalistic integrity, but I don't think that they're an objective news source all the time.
Right.
And I think that's the issue here. Where you want, like, it's not. As much as it's like, I don't know, like maybe it's a generational thing. Maybe I'm not the type to think that the people have a right to know, that's kind of the idea that I feel exists behind journalism. And when the people only have a right to know if you can afford to write it down because someone's paying you for that particular story, that's where you have a problem.
Yeah, I do. And I think from like a philosophy, from, you know, just a higher level, you know, ordeal, that is what we aim for, having, you know, news sources that aren't behind, where the money isn't isn't the root cause and focus and how they define what, you know, is legitimate and what's not legitimate. And maybe I'm a little jaded given that, you know, nowadays we notice it everywhere, be it game reviews. If you recall, there's quite a lot of sites that, you know, their ads and their reviews have come into question, be it movie reviews, be it, you know, all different spheres.
Yeah, and there's a lot of gushing. There's a lot of, like, lack of critical thought when it comes to some of this stuff because there's all this gushing, and the gushing happens because people are trying to get paid and maintain access, you know? So I'm not saying that BuzzFeed is there or whatever. I'm saying that as an educated society, we have to be somewhat vigilant of that. Just like how, you know, I was talking about Fox News, MSNBC. They know that, you know, their slogan is lean forward. They're focused on the progressive liberal policies of the left. So they're going to do what they can do to get that audience. You know what I mean? So.
But by the way, Tosin, you were talking about the BuzzFeed BuzzFeed Motion Pictures, their video arm. That division of theirs is being headed by Z Frank. I don't know if you remember Z Frank. He was a huge YouTube celebrity back in the day, and he was known for his short videos and his apps, his little flash apps, and the fact that he never blinked in his videos because he cut all the blinks out. So he's heading their video unit. Speaking of YouTube stars, a new variety survey came out this week that Variety commissioned that shows that U.S. teenagers are more enamored with YouTube stars than they are with the biggest celebrities in film, TV, and music. Five of the most influential figures amongst Americans aged 13 to 18 are all YouTube faves, eclipsing mainstream celebrities, including Jennifer Lawrence and Seth Rogen. The highest ranking figures were Smosh, which is the online comedy team of Ian Andrew Hecox and Anthony Padilla. I've never even heard of Smosh.
Where have you been, Andrew Swissini, not know about Smosh?
I guess I've been under a rock. I've been older than 18. Older than that age range of 13 to 18, I guess. The Fine Brothers. I'm familiar with the Fine Brothers because I see their work all the time online, where they do the kids talk about this thing, or old people talk about this thing. And then, of course, Felix Arvid Ulf Kjellberg, otherwise known as PewDiePie, who is a YouTube. Basically, he plays games, and you get to watch him play games online. Interestingly enough, in their survey, the highest ranking actual, you know, movie celebrity is Paul Walker, and he comes in at number 6 on
that list. Isn't
he dead? Yeah.
Yes, he did pass away. I would love to know how they polled these people and more information on the stats around it, because I don't know. You know, maybe I don't know teens these days, but it just seems really odd to me that Paul Walker would be the number one when you know, like, people like Beyonce and all these other, like,
Justin Bieber.
Think about the period of time that this survey was taken, and Paul Walker was probably in the news quite a bit because of his death, so... I think, you know, it would depend on when the survey was taken as well. Jennifer Lawrence is number 7, followed by Katy Perry, Steve Carell, Seth Rogen, Betty White for some reason at number 12.
Well, Betty White has had an incredible internet renaissance. She's had her own reconnaissance, you know. So there definitely is that. I don't disbelieve this. I think there is something here, perhaps, and I think that has to do with the fact that while so many millennials, so many like aged millennials, you know, in their 30s now, in their 30s now, are more focused on streaming old media or revisiting, you know, old media. You get this kind of like resurgence of some of that old media in new media formats like Arrested Development and so on. If you're younger, And you're getting online at, like, you know, as a young kid at, like, let's call it 7, 8, you're online by yourself, maybe a little bit. You know, YouTube is right there. There's no barrier. You don't have to figure out anything. I mean, I was just on Secret having this argument with people because they were, like, trying to justify illegal downloading things. But when you're, like, growing up with YouTube as your entertainment, you don't need to go illegally download anything. You're not figuring out how to torrent or whatever. So these people on YouTube that have regularness because, you know, they're on YouTube, but you can make a YouTube video if you want, that kind of thing. These people have more in common. And they're moving, like, you know, I think the younger side of the millennial generation and the post-millennial generation are moving away from the way we distribute mass media content in favor of this more democratized production of content. And the speed at which it comes out and the speed at which it can be topical and the way it can transmit news in addition to entertainment. And to me, it makes sense that if you're a youngster and you're hopping on YouTube with maybe some parental controls in place, you can really watch hours and hours and hours of content without even thinking about Jennifer who or Paul what or Beyonce who, you know, that kind of thing.
I know this to be true firsthand because my own daughter, you know, for the longest time, like, I was completely mystified by the whole phenomenon of these game videos where it's literally just, you know, a live stream of people playing these video games. I could not wrap my head. It definitely was a generational gap for me. Like, I could not figure out what was the appeal to this. And then I would sit and watch my daughter load these videos up and watch them concurrent, you know, watch them successively, just video after video after video of these guys just playing around in Minecraft.
I used to do that with my cousin.
Uh-huh.
And by that I mean he would play Nintendo and I would watch him play Nintendo. I mean, he was good at certain games and I just liked watching him play the games. There's something weird and cathartic about watching, let's call it a TV show, of, you know, someone's manipulating right in front of your hand, in front of your face.
Yeah.
You know? So there is something there.
I kind of get it. I mean, I still don't think it's that appealing to me. Like, I couldn't sit down and I would get bored out of my skull. Like, I need to be told a story. I think maybe that's just my generation. But I definitely see how it would appeal to a younger sensibility.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see how YouTube stars would be more popular. I just think their mainstream celebs is all messed up, so...
it's interesting. Well, you know, I'll have to forward you. Well, the link will be in the show notes. You should take a look at this list because they've got the graphic that sort of breaks down the top 20 celebrities. Like Leonardo DiCaprio is way down at number 20.
Right, because he's our guy. He's not their guy.
Right.
He's our youth guy. The girls who fell in love with Leonardo DiCaprio are now in their 30s.
Yes. Thank you for reminding me. This is true.
If Justin Bieber wasn't on there, I would be a little suspect.
I don't think he is on there.
He's not on there.
Yeah,
okay. So, I mean, there's some issues perhaps there. But I don't know how his popularity is faring now that he, you know, went to jail and all this stuff.
Sure. Being and, like, gets in fights. And
yeah, he was basically
people love to hate him, so I don't know if,
I think his publicist gave him some bad instructions because, I mean, the stuff he does is bereft of judgment of anyone normal. So I think someone said, keep and stay in the news, buddy. And he's like, okay.
I'll just be an ass. That's how I stay in the news.
I'm going to spit my fans from my hotel room balcony.
The people who conducted the survey for Variety say that Hollywood should take a page from the YouTube playbook. By encouraging unvarnished individualism, studios and network can help foster traditional celebs appeal amongst younger demographics.
Yeah, it's the unvarnished situation. I mean, I think, you know, you look at Justin Timberlake and his career had a big renaissance, or at least a huge bump when he got to a place where he could make fun of himself. He was unvarnished. That's a big thing. And I think that's something that we have to think about. I mean, between this story and what's gone on with Netflix and HBO, it's clear that Hollywood needs help.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We're going to take one last break. And when we come back, people will no longer be bored with your long-ass GoPro videos. And our drill down video of the week asks, when the robots take over, how will you make a living? So take a listen to this and come on back.
Thank you very much, oh Mr. Roboto. Don't worry, Mr. Anyone's doing. Thank you very much, oh Mr. Roboto, for helping me escape to where I needed to. The problem's plain to see. Too much technology. Machines to save our lives. Machines dehumanize.
You're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini, here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafuaken. We got a couple of interesting Drill Down videos of the week this week. And the first one, let's talk about the CGP Grey one first here. So CGP Grey, who is another YouTube producer, speaking of YouTube producers like we did before the break, this guy is fairly well known for his... he basically produces explanatory videos where he explains. And one of the most famous ones that he did was the explanation of the terminology of the British Isles, like what is considered the UK, what is considered Great Britain, what is considered England. So he does a lot of these explanatory videos. And this is his longest one to date, and it's called... it's called Humans Need Not Apply. And this sort of carries on a theme that we've been talking about on the Drill Down over the last few episodes. And in particular, we talked about it during one of our Audible segments when we talked about the book called Our Final Invention, which is about the rise of artificial intelligence and how it will eventually... how it may eventually overtake humanity. And this video sort of underscores that point in that with the rise of intelligent robots, and by robots I don't mean literally physical robots, but programs and processes that automate.
Well, I mean, he means both, I feel like. He starts by bridging. So this is a little different from his other videos. In his other videos, he explains things. Here, he analyzes things. He's able to take a whole bunch of seemingly disparate stuff, and he says, if you notice how they relate, and if you notice how history has happened in the past, we're in a position where while we have always adapted to mechanical and, you know, software improvements, and we found a place for ourselves, we may not be able to adapt to what's coming when it comes to both mechanical and software improvements. So he has a couple talks. He talks about the transportation industry and what happens when the transportation industry is tied to autonomous vehicles. And then that's a bridge to understanding what happens with software. And he actually goes into multiple disciplines. And he finds ways to he explains and analyzes the way a computer could actually take over myriad types of positions. We're talking highly professional positions, positions that aren't the typical unskilled labor that gets replaced on the dock or in the factory. Music creation, you know, legal analysis.
Yeah,
these things that computers can take over. So he's asking, well, what do we do? Is the big question. And he does it in a way that the journey across his understanding, across how he's laying this out, is incredibly important. I mean, Steve Ballmer and others have said that, you know, there are two things that are coming that we're not prepared for. You know, big data and robotics. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you look at both of them, this idea that we've kind of scratched the surface of, the singularity, it represents something akin to the Industrial Revolution, only far more reaching and far more insidious. Insidious being sneaks up on you and then becomes a big deal. So that this video, I think, is incredibly powerful in laying that out, and saying that if you think you're prepared for this kind of change, think again, because you may not be. Not that we can't prepare, but it's something that you just kind of have to think about. Especially if you're a person who has children today and you're wondering what they're going to be when they grow up, you know?
Right.
I have a friend, and well, not a friend. She was a mentor of mine. And when I was an intern out of college, she actually said she wanted her daughter to become a plumber. And I remember giggling at that idea. You know, she works in high tech and she wants her daughter to become a plumber.
You know, it makes sense.
Because, you know, a plumber can pull in hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of dollars a year because it's not a job that can be simply automated. Even if they're using systems to help them with their work in terms of architecture or whatever, you know, that's a job that requires, at least with our current understanding, the maintenance and fixing of someone's plumbing, much less so the design or, you know, creation of a new home. But the maintenance and fixing of someone's plumbing has everything to do with being a person. And that's key. So you have to just kind of look at it and not be as scared as you are intrigued about problem solving for yourself and for your future.
Sure. I love how he used the analogy in this video of the horse and how the horseless carriage was thought to – it was going to free up a lot of the labor that had been previously used by horses – and allow horses to take on a broader range of less menial tasks, like less plowing and less heavy lifting, and more more leisure use. And how
that has happened.
It did happen, but then eventually the horses were completely made obsolete.
Well, I think that's not true. I mean, what he laid out was the decline in horse population as horses were no longer used for labor. But if you look closely at what we use horses for, which is recreation, people who have money own horses, and or, you know, racing. Recreational riding and racing. And I think that is true possibly of what happens with humanity on some level. I think that in a world where we have the machines do more work for us, we may very well have less people. And I don't think that that's a bad thing.
Right, but it may not be by choice.
What does that mean? Like, if there's a question of, I mean, right now we have 7 billion people on the planet Earth, right? Yeah. And when you look at what in some of the countries with larger populations, how they're dealing with skilled labor. I mean, China itself has tried to limit its population as much as any country ever could. We look at people coming out, coming from one country, migrating to another for jobs and everything. The reason those other countries, in many ways, have such high populations and such big population growth is because it is relatively inexpensive to have a child and raise it based on the income there. Now, if we all lived in a world where automation was a big part of everything and it was more expensive, like the Western world is today, we'd all have less children. By bringing the lifestyle of the West across to countries with exploding populations, all the automation that comes with it declines that population because you can have your work focusing on having a higher quality childhood experience for your children, so you have less children. If we can move that up tenfold, then yeah, it's likely that we'll all have less children. We'll just focus on that experience or that kind of thing. And that means our population will decline. But is that a negative? I don't know that it is. I don't know that it isn't, but I don't know that it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the question that I have about all of that is that when robots do edge out human occupations, and we are all sort of trying to figure out what we're going to be doing to pay for our cost of living, pay for our, because we still have to be useful, But when we've given all of our useful activity up to the robots, there is going to be a culture shock there, and that culture shock is going to result in depending on how we decide to deal with it. Our culture shock is either going to be very violent, or you know, we're going to ease into it. And I think history has shown that changes like this can tend to be really sort of violently shocking.
I mean, was the automobile violently shocking to horses? No, we didn't slaughter our horses.
No, we didn't slaughter the horses, but we stopped using them for service. And then,
which is a better thing for the horses. I mean, just recently in New York, we passed laws to say, you know, we're phasing out the handsome carriages, where horses were still doing some work, and we consider it not humane. Now, is it like the Great Wall of China, right? A million people died during the creation of that Great Wall. God knows how many people died during the creation of the pyramids. Right now, the creation of roads, buildings, construction workers are dying all the time. People die when performing labor. We could limit those deaths. That's great. If there are less people, that's also great. More people is not better people. And in fact, I think we can, like, a scientific understanding of what's going on the planet right now has everything to do with the fact that we have a lot of people to feed and to provide energy for and all these things. So if in 6 or 7 generations, the human population is hanging out at 5 billion instead of 20 billion, I don't think, or even 3 billion, I don't think that that's a negative thing for the ecosystem and for lifestyle.
Well, I hope that that's the case. I hope it's a matter of a gradual sort of thinning out due to not needing to have more people on Earth to attend to the labor, rather than a violent upheaval of people fighting for resources because they can't. They cannot attain the jobs to pay for their cost of living.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's a difficult thing to think about that way. But if you also think about it, you know, if there's a lot of unemployment right now, the labor class is a class no one wants to be a part of. So if we can remove, and since the labor class is the largest class on the planet, yeah, humanity would shrink. Mm-hmm. I mean, unemployment is a big problem. Unemployment across the world. Constitute, you know, when you go to the country with the highest levels of unemployment, that's where you get things like radical right-wing stuff or terrorism and things like that, because you have a whole bunch of males usually that don't have anything to do, and they get riled up and they can get seduced by the wants and needs in the rhetoric of people who can say, I can give your life meaning. I don't think that people won't have meaning, and I think I look at, you know, the ancient philosophers who wish that they were shepherds because they'd have all the time in the world to think. And when you look at some of that crazy science fiction that shows, like, you know, some, you know, energy-based being that was like humans 5 million years ago, that's why. Because they automated the crap out of everything and they just thought them were their way into, like, super evolution.
So far, technology hasn't been a completely terrible thing, and we've been able to advance in other ways and open up, you know, we've been able to open up new positions in other places where we didn't in particular have them. So, you know, I think life goes on.
Life goes on. Well, let's end this podcast tonight on a happier note, since it got a little heavy here. Our other video of the week here is from Microsoft Research. Now, Microsoft Research's Johannes Kopf discovered shortly after purchasing a GoPro and strapping it on for a climb in the Cascades, that he wanted to show his friends, like, the full experience of getting up one of these mountains from base camp to summit, but in an attempt to speed up 5 hours of footage significantly, it amplified the camera's slightest movements, which made the video unwatchable. And all of the current stabilization techniques are no match for the camera's constant movements. So he and colleagues Michael Cohen and Rich Zaliski from Microsoft Research developed a program called Hyperlapse, which is an advanced stabilization technology that virtually eliminates camera shake, creating a fast, smooth visual path through the full length of a video. It crops out. So normal video stabilization crops out the pixels on the periphery to create consistent frame-to-frame smoothness, but when applied to greatly sped-up video, it fails to compensate for the wildly shaking motion. What Hyperlapse does is reconstruct how a camera moves through a video, as well as its distance and angle in relation to what's happening in each frame. And then it plots out a smoother camera path and stitches pixels from multiple video frames to rebuild the scene and expand the field of view. But it's fascinating to watch this in action when you see this. He's got Johannes Koff's got examples of him climbing in the Cascades, as well as doing a bike ride through town. Either it's a bike ride or a walk. I can't tell by the way he's fast forwarded this. It's so smooth. It seems to work better on in urban environments with streets and houses and trees than it does in the mountain climbing. I think because of the sort of organic fractalness of the landscape of mountain climbing tends to accentuate sort of the weird stitching that is occurring in this. What did you guys think of this?
I thought it was interesting. I don't know that I was like, wow, this is the future, as much as I was like, you know, this is something that I could see myself, you know, using when I want to edit video. I think it's a worthwhile situation. I dug it.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I mean, able to have that sort of seamless camera to mm-hmm. it. I think for those who are doing a lot of the outdoor stuff with GoPros, etc., I think it's going to be fairly remarkable in having that sort of unique view. But I think that's still a very segmented portion, and we wait and see what other means that this can be used in.
Yeah.
Maybe in film technology. I think what was actually really cool is that reminded me of a clip I saw of this sort of camera tripod, where to avoid the sort of motion that you get, it had the ability to rotate around it. Did you guys see that as well too?
No.
I've seen stabilization systems that are similar.
Yeah, stabilization systems, except...
this is the one physical. Where the guy's holding it and he's running around. He's, like, moving around it, but, like, it's not... The camera's not moving.
Right. Yeah. Except that's physical rather than software.
Fake. I thought it was fake.
It very well may have
been. No. No, there are legitimate stabilization systems that are like this. They're quite expensive.
But having it in technology... Having it as a software layer, that's... Yeah. That's cool. I mean, I think, you know, movies, film industries, although the award system may be somewhat outdated, film industries are where you see a lot of technology hit first, you know, prior to becoming consumer. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it's also one of those things where, you know, at the software level, if people are able to use it pretty quickly, it does what we were talking about before. It just gets more editors out of the editing seats and makes them, you know, sit around and twiddle their thumbs.
Oh, you hit me where I live, man.
Like most things, editors will be able to get more work done because they're not worried about how to deal with all that footage.
Makes me want to take off my wooden clogs and throw them into the machinery that is
your Sebo.
Yeah.
So here's the thing, like, you think about it, and, like, let's face it, there's a ton of stuff that, like, when digital cameras came out and digital video became a thing, I have an old colleague and his brother worked for Battlestar Galactica, and you know, when it was being produced, mm-hmm. and he let us know that one of the issues with all the digital video was that they got all this digital video and they had to produce a 43 minute episode out of it, where they used to get a few hours of it. They would get tens upon tens upon tens of hours because the directors were just like, yeah, take more video. Right. So they had to do more work because it was easier to shoot this work. So this reverses that a little bit. When there's that kind of footage, at least you can have the computer smooth it out before you have to put it into whatever.
Yeah. So I mean, I think it's early days now because when you see this, it's not entirely I looked at this video and I put it on the highest resolution setting, and it's fairly, you know, clear in the center of the frame, but on the edges where all the algorithmic magic is happening, it's really sort of kind of fuzzy and rough. So it's early days with this technology, but I think it can only get better. Yeah. All right, let's call it a night, end this podcast, and go around the table here. I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DWAYNED. I am a contributing writer for VentureBeat. I also write on the Drill Down podcast, and you can check me out on DwayneD.flavors.me. Also, one shout out to Greg Davies, who was on the Blend Over on Monday.
Yeah.
Check out the Blend Over if you haven't. Andy's on it. Mm-hmm. I'm on it. It's a lot of
fun. You and I were both on it this last week.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good show. You know, it definitely hits that undercover news. And for everybody out there, Geeks of Doom is bringing back the TARDIS blend. And yep. I know that Andy's going to be on some of those episodes. I might be on some of those episodes. Yeah. But really, the stars, Tom and Greg, they're going to be running the show. And they are extremely excited. It is spoiler-free. It is rumor-free. But it's chock full of goodness.
Oh, I don't know if it's rumor-free. I think No.
I was talking to Greg specifically.
Really?
Like, this season, they're not doing the rumor thing.
Interesting.
They're you know, at least during this they didn't want to do the rumor thing during this kind of interregnum between doctors and everything. But one of the big things they're trying to do is they're trying to, like, pay attention to the text of the shows and glean what information they can out of that. It's a new season, a new doctor, a new thing, so they're trying something new themselves. And I think it's really exciting. I think Geeks of Doom has a great lineup this fall.
Yep. So check them out. Geeksofdoom.com. That's where we're on. That's where TARDIS Blend will be on. Just great all-around coverage.
How about you, Tosin?
You can find me on Twitter.com at twitter.com/toast4321. Other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com, as well as toastr2d2.tumblr.com. Eventually will be updated. You guys will be the first to know when I update that.
Very cool.
How about you, Andrew?
You can find me at mrbabyman.com. That's my social media handle. And all of my social media links are there. Just Google Mr. Baby Man. You'll find all my stuff there. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, you can send your story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish here at The Drill Down. You can let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.